Well, good morning. Great to be with everybody. 2012, first day, wouldn't want to be with anybody else other than you. Yes. And if you're newer here today, glad that you're here. A few things to help you out. First of all of us got a little program. It gives you some information, some background in here. Recommend you reading that when you leave. Even it's great John reading material. And not even as good as this. We have a new updated version of this thing called Context you can get at the Information Center. Gives you context for who we are, why we do certain things, what the method to our madness is. We'd recommend you picking that up. It'll help you get the most out of understanding this thing that is called Crossroads. Those of us who were around in 2011, a couple big things that we saw that were pretty cool. We had our Angel Tree. We were able to collect 54. We had 54,000 people gifts going out to kids who normally wouldn't have a gift on Christmas. Awesome. Often 54,000 gifts, all from you all. And you know, we really hammer people, making sure that you brought back gifts, or else if you signed up for them and didn't bring them back, you were a naughty, naughty boy. And you know, we had 85 gifts not come back. 85. And here's the names of everybody who didn't know. Actually, that's pretty impressive. Only 85 gifts didn't come back out of 54,000 pre-committed. And here's the other amazing thing. The other amazing thing is we knew that some would not be able to for various reasons. They'd forget, or maybe a tragedy came up or something like that. And we had, ahead of time, exactly 85 people signed up to stand in the gap. That's amazing. 85. So we had 85 gifts. Well, we're there ready to go, and 85 didn't show up. That's what you call the providence of God. That's not great planning. That's calling God being in charge. Really, really great stuff. We also had a great thing over Awaited. How many of us had a good time at Awaited this year? Yeah, great. We had, at all of our shows at Awaited, we had 44,000 people actually attend this year. That's 30% more than last year. And a lot of stories of people getting the understanding of Christmas for the very first time. A lot of profound moments happen with people. And now our issue is going to be, normally we just try to figure out how do we improve the show every year, add a scene, make it tighter, better. Now we're kind of figuring out, gosh, I don't know how many more shows we can do next year, what we can possibly do. But it's a good problem to have, really good problem to have. So we're just thankful for the things that God's done in our midst over 2011 and specifically the holiday season. We're going to have the opportunity to be generous. If you're newer today, excited you're here. We don't have any expectations of you being generous. But for those of us who call this place our church, we want to align ourselves with God, which means we want to align ourselves with His attributes, which are generosity. These little bags are a way for us to do that or remind us to do it in some other form. So we're going to have the opportunity to do that. As we do that, we're going to take a look at a video that gives us some insight as to what we just experienced in 2011. Boy, some of those things on there seem like it just happened yesterday. Others of those things seem like it happened 5 years ago. You know, one of the phrases that I've heard a lot this year in different contexts, maybe you have too, is actually a movie that's by this title too. It's the phrase, wait, what just happened? What just happened? 2011, what just happened? I've heard people say that when something really funny happens and they go, whoa, what just happened? When something really profound is said in a room that adjusts the temperature of the room, what just happened? And we're today going to look not really at the world events of 2011 that just happened. I want to try to equip you to be able to take a look at your own life from the last 12 months and say, what just happened in order to set you up for the next 12 months. I want to get you and enable you to spiritually grow. And there's some definitive steps that everybody takes to spiritually grow. And I'm going to talk about those today. So let's pray before I go further. Father, I'm thankful for the opportunity to be here. I really am. I mean, it's great that people are here on New Year's Day. And I'm one of the only people in the room who's actually here as a part of my job. But I'd actually, even though I wasn't getting paid to be here, I'd actually be here anyway because I can't really think of a better place to be than here right now or a better snippet of a day for New Year's Day than reflecting on these things and setting us up for our future. So I pray that you do that in a unique way. Help us to remember and help us to embrace the coming year. I pray these things according to your character. Amen. Well, I have up here on my little thing, this is my own little nourishment. This is for some nourishment. It's actually not for me to eat specifically, but it's going to be an example today of the different kinds of time that we live in and embrace. There's two different words for time that are in the New Testament that are in the original Greek language. And God in time is doing the same thing today that he has always been doing. Jesus one time, when he referred to God, the Father, and himself, he says in John chapter 5, my Father is always at his work to this very day, and I too am working. I too am working. What does God do in every morning? He goes to work. What has God been doing in the last year of your life? He has been working. God is always at work. Jesus is always at work. And in order to spiritually grow, this has to be grappled. Our lives are not just a series of random coincidences or accidents that come together. There are things that God is doing right now, and somebody who is becoming spiritually mature learns how to notice when and where God is at work and then adjust accordingly. I'm telling you, the last 12 months of your life, God has been working in your life. And I just think that many of us have forgotten this or have not been able to identify when and where he has been working, the times that he's been working. This bowl represents not just a good little snack, peanut M&Ms. How many of us have seen the truth in the life and understand peanut M&Ms are better than regular M&Ms? How many of us, regular peanut, yes, they are the way, they are. This bowl represents two forms of time that are in the Bible. The Bible has two different Greek words in the New Testament that are both translated time, but they're totally different concepts. One is the Greek word chronos, which is where we get the word chronological. This is chronos time. This is all of the, if you will, the seconds in a minute, the minutes in an hour, the hours in a day, days in a year, years in a lifetime. Chronos, chronological time, just marches on. This is an amalgamation of chronos. Yet at the same time, in the midst of our chronological year, God has been working, and there are specific moments that are important, specific moments that are also time, but they're not chronos, they are kairos. A kairos moment. Yes. A kairos, and when you can identify not just the passing of chronos time, and when you can identify the unique moments when God has been working your life, the unique kairos moment, you have staged yourself for spiritual growth. If you have not learned how to do this, you're not going to grow. You're not where you are today as a result of happenstance. You're growing because you're noticing the unique moments where God breaks in, the kairos moments. So, examples of the difference here. Chronos is spatial. Spatial time. Kairos is special. Chronos is spatial related. Kairos is special. It's a special moment. Chronos is cumulative. It's cumulative. Kairos is definitive. Chronos, chronological, it is seconds, whereas kairos is significance. So let's take a look at some examples of how these are different. First of all, chronos in the New Testament. Here's some examples. For I do not want to see you now just in passing. I hope to spend some time with you if the Lord permits. I want to spend some time with you. I want to spend a bunch of seconds, a bunch of chronos minutes with you, the Apostle Paul says to the church that he's planted in Corinth. Here's another example. But when the fullness of time had come, God sent forth his son, born of a woman. When all of the previous years that had come before AD, whatever it was when Jesus was born, when all the fullness of time, Jesus was born. These are chronos. Now, kairos, specific moments where God is working, where people have the opportunity to grab hold of something and change and grow. Here's the first example. Jesus says, you hypocrites, you know how to interpret the appearance of earth and sky, but why do you not know how to interpret the present time, the present kairos? He's talking with religious people here right now, and he says, you know, religious people, you know, you know all your Bible verses, you know all your little sayings, like red sky at night, sailor's delight, red sky in morning, sailors take warning. I mean, you understand this thing, but yet you don't understand how to interpret the Kairos moment of me being here right now. You can't see all the prophecies that I am fulfilling from the Old Testament scriptures. This is a Kairos, and you can't see it. You don't get this moment, this definitive special moment. Here's another one. Walk in wisdom towards outsiders, making the best use of the Kairos. Let your speech always be gracious, seasoned with salt, so that you may know how you ought to answer each person. This is written to people who have a relationship with Jesus, and we bump in with people who may be skeptics or seekers or not sure, that maybe they don't even like us. It's a Kairos moment. It's a Kairos moment to not combat judgmentalism with judgmentalism, but to actually give them grace, give somebody grace, give them insights. It's a defining special moment to model a life that's a bit different. One more example. For a while we were still weak, at the right time, Kairos, Christ died for the ungodly. Special moment, special moment. Right moment. Instead of Brian trying to impress God and work off my sin, no, at the right time, the right definitive special moment, Jesus died for me so I don't have to work to earn God's approval. These are Kairos moments. Now, how do we grow? The way you grow is to understand that there are certain moments that are special that are different. And so the way you spiritually grow is a three-step process. It is, number one, you reflect. Number two, you retain. Number three, you redirect. You reflect on your life. You think about it. You retain the moments that were Kairos significant moments where God was working, teaching you, working in you. And then three, you redirect the entire trajectory of your life to go in that direction more often. So I've been doing this last week. In part, I've been doing this last week because I knew I was going to talk about it this week. But I do it this time of year every year. It's a regular pattern for me to sit down and reflect the moments of my last year where something unique happened, where something happened that was profound, that was something I needed to learn from. And you need to do this. You need to do this this week. You need to do this today, perhaps. Here's how you do it. One of three ways you can do it. First is, if you keep a journal or diary, which I do, it's normally not all that good. I mean, sometimes I'll write a half page. Sometimes I go 2 weeks where there's just one sentence in it. But nonetheless, I have written forms dated where I can just kind of leaf through my journal and go, oh, yeah, I remember that. Oh, I remember I wrote that verse down. I can do that to reflect on the things of this last year. Here's another thing you can do. You cannot go through your pictures. Actually, that's very hard for us. We're in a digital age right now. Well, you ever notice how many pictures we take right now? It's really good. Let me tell you something. Back in my day when I was growing up, we had this thing called film. I don't know if you ever heard or seen this. Here's the way it was like to take pictures back then. Today, we just take pictures in all kind of chronos. Oh, chronos, boo, take a picture. Back when, it was only Kairos moments you would take pictures of because you actually would have to go to a store, buy this stuff called film. You'd actually have to take a camera, open up the back, click, and you have to put it inside the camera and click it down, and you could never open that until all of your film was done, either 12, 24, or 36 exposures. And then you'd have this camera all of a sudden, oh, something special, somebody's birthday or something. Oh, I go to the drawer, pull it out, go click, and you have no idea what came out in film. It's just, I press the button, I assume something is in there, and then you'd put it away because that stuff was too expensive, and then all of a sudden a new Kairos moment would come, or you might think that you might see one the place you're going, so you take your camera, and sure enough, click, and then finally after about 9 months, you've been saving up these pictures, you take them to a store, and you give them to somebody, and then you have to come back five days later, pay more money. And now you see your pictures, and you got your thumb on some of them, and other ones. You're going, why did I waste my money? But nonetheless, you could go through a photo album, and you were pretty certain to be taking Kairos moments in your photo album, where today, digital pictures are like, oh, there's a doorknob. Never seen one like that before. Click, you know, and we have, oh, interesting. But look through your photo log of the last year to spark your memory of what happened. Another one, your calendar. Go back your calendar. Notice your meetings. These are just certain ways to actually reflect. In fact, right now, we're going to actually not learn things. We're going to do things. So I'm going to give you about 30 seconds. Pull out your calendar. Pull out your smartphone right now. You're going to make an appointment with yourself right now to do this sometime the next week.
Some of you didn't bring your smartphones, or you think I'm kidding, or you really are not going to grow because you're going, I don't have to do that. Yeah, that's exactly why your 2010 was just like your 2011 and will be like your 2012. I'm telling you, I am being a jerk, but I'm actually trying to motivate you. I'm telling you, do the same thing you've always done, you'll get the same thing you've always gotten. If you've not done this before, I'm telling you, you have to do this. Make an appointment with yourself right now to have whatever it is, 15 minutes, a half hour, an hour, to reflect on the last year of your life, to notice the Kairos moments, and then be able to retain them and redirect them. All right, now, let me, as an example, I'm going to share with you some of my Kairos moments, the moments that something happened. When I knew in the moment, I went, ooh, my goodness, what just happened? Some of these moments, in the moment, I knew this is a Kairos moment. There's something special and significant. Some of these moments, they felt like Kronos time. I was just kind of going through the motions. But and looking back on my year, I realized, oh, wow, I'm glad that I reflected, because that thing back there, I would have blown by that one, and that was significant. It was important. I'm going to give you some of mine today. Some of them I'm not going to give you because I just don't want to go public with them. Other ones, it wouldn't be helpful for you. I think these are five that are important enough to talk about. And the first one actually happened when I was in the midst of a meeting with some pastors. It was by invitation only. It was a group of pastors, so we were down in Texas, just trying to think through, what does the future of the church look like? What kind of new model should we be open to? And there was a video shown that was a Kairos moment for me that didn't just impact how I'm thinking about Crossroads. It impacted me about a bunch of things happening in my life. And I'll just show you the stimulus. Here's the stimulus of that Kairos moment. It's a bit long, but it's worth it. Check it out.
Every country on earth at the moment is reforming public education. There are two reasons for it. The first of them is economic. People are trying to work out, how do we educate our children to take their place in the economies of the 21st century? How do we do that? Given that we can't anticipate what the economy will look like at the end of next week, as the recent turmoil is demonstrating. How do we do that? The second, though, is cultural. Every country on earth is trying to figure out, how do we educate our children so they have a sense of cultural identity, and so that we can pass on the cultural genes of our communities while being part of the process of globalization. How do we square that circle? The problem is they're trying to meet the future by doing what they did in the past. And on the way, they're alienating millions of kids who don't see any purpose in going to school. When we went to school, we were kept there with a story, which is if you worked hard and did well and got a college degree, you would have a job. Our kids don't believe that. And they're right not to, by the way. You're better having a degree than not, but it's not a guarantee anymore. And particularly not if the route to it marginalizes most of the things that you think are important about yourself. Some people say we have to raise standards if this is a breakthrough. You know, like, really, yes, we should. Why would you lower them? You know, I mean, I haven't come across an argument that persuades me of lowering them. But raising them, of course we should raise them. The problem is that the current system of education was designed and conceived and structured for a different age. It was conceived in the intellectual culture of the Enlightenment and in the economic circumstances of the Industrial Revolution. Before the middle of the 19th century, there were no systems of public education. Not really. I mean, you could get educated by Jesuits, you know, if you had the money. But public education, paid for from taxation, compulsory to everybody and free at the point of delivery, that was a revolutionary idea. And many people objected to it. They said it's not possible for many street kids, working class children, to benefit from public education. They're incapable of learning to read and write, and why are we spending time on this? So there's also built into it a whole series of assumptions about social structure and capacity. It was driven by an economic imperative of the time, but running right through it was an intellectual model of the mind, which was essentially the Enlightenment view of intelligence, that real intelligence consists in the capacity for a certain type of deductive reasoning and a knowledge of the classics originally, what we come to think of as academic ability. And this is deep in the gene pool of public education, that there are really two types of people, academic and non-academic. smart people and non-smart people. And the consequence of that is that many brilliant people think they're not, because they've been judged against this particular view of the mind. So we have twin pillars, economic and intellectual. And my view is that this model has caused chaos in many people's lives. It's been great for some. There have been people who have benefited wonderfully from it. But most people have not. Instead, they suffer this. This is the modern epidemic, and it's as misplaced and it's as fictitious. This is the plague of ADHD. Now, this is a map of the incidence of ADHD in America, or prescriptions for ADHD. Don't mistake me here. I don't mean to say there is no such thing as attention deficit disorder. I'm not qualified to say if there is such a thing. I know that a great majority of psychologists and pediatricians think there is such a thing. But it's still a matter of debate. What I do know for a fact is it's not an epidemic. These kids are being medicated as routinely as we had our tonsils taken out. And on the same whimsical basis, and for the same reason, medical fashion. Our children are living in the most intensely stimulating period in the history of the earth. They're being besieged with information and calls for their attention from every platform, computers, from iPhones, from advertising audience, from hundreds of television channels. And we're penalizing them now for getting distracted. From what? You know, boring stuff at school, for the most part. It seems to me it's not a coincidence, totally, that the incidence of ADHD has risen in parallel with the growth of standardized testing. Now, these kids are being given Ritalin and Adderall and all manner of things, often quite dangerous drugs, to get them focused and calm them down. But according to this, attention deficit disorder increases as you travel east across the country. People start losing interest in Oklahoma. They can hardly think straight in Arkansas. And by the time they get to Washington, they've lost it completely. And there are separate reasons for that, I believe. It's a fictitious epidemic. If you think of it, the arts, and I don't say this exclusively the arts, I think it's also true of science and of maths, but I say about the arts particularly because they are the victims of this mentality currently, particularly. The arts especially address the idea of aesthetic experience. An aesthetic experience is one in which your senses are operating at their peak, when you're present in the current moment, when you're resonating with the excitement of this thing that you're experiencing, when you are fully alive. An anesthetic is when you shut your senses off and deaden yourself to what's happening. And a lot of these drugs are that. We're getting our children through education by anesthetizing them. And I think we should be doing the exact opposite. We shouldn't be putting them asleep. We should be waking them up to what they have inside of themselves. But the model we have is this. I believe we have a system of education that is modeled on the interests of industrialism and in the image of it. I'll give you a couple of examples. Schools are still pretty much organized on factory lines, ringing bells, separate facilities, specialized into separate subjects. We still educate children by batches. You know, we put them through the system by age group. Why do we do that? You know, why is there this assumption that the most important thing kids have in common is how old they are? You know, it's like the most important thing about them is their date of manufacture. You know what I mean? Well, I know kids who are much better than other kids at the same age in different disciplines, you know, or at different times of the day, or better in smaller groups than in large groups, or sometimes they want to be on their own. If you're interested in the model of learning, you don't start from this production line mentality. It's essentially about conformity, and increasingly it's about that as you look at the growth of standardized testing and standardized curricula. And it's about standardization. I believe we've got to go in the exact opposite direction. That's what I mean about changing the paradigm. There was a great study done recently of divergent thinking. It was published a couple of years ago. Divergent thinking isn't the same thing as creativity. I define creativity as the process of having original ideas that have value. Divergent thinking isn't a synonym, but it's an essential capacity for creativity. It's the ability to see lots of possible answers to a question, lots of possible ways of interpreting a question, to think what Edward de Bono would probably call laterally, to think not just in linear or convergent ways, to see multiple answers, not one. So, I mean, there are tests for this. I mean, one kind of cod example would be people might be asked to say, how many uses can you think of for a paperclip? Well, those routine questions. Most people might come up with 10 or 15. People who are good at this might come up with 200. And they do that by saying, well, could the paperclip be 200 foot tall and be made out of foam rubber? You know, like, does it have to be a paperclip as we know it, Jim? You know. Now, there are tests for this, and they gave them to 1,500 people. This is in a book called Breakpoint and Beyond. And on the protocol of the test, if you scored above a certain level, you'd be considered to be a genius at divergent thinking. Okay? So my question to you is, what percentage of the people tested, of the 1,500, scored at genius level for divergent thinking? Now, you need to know one more thing about them. These were kindergarten children. So what do you think? What percentage at genius level?
80.
80, okay. 98%. Now, the thing about this was it was a longitudinal study. So they retested the same children 5 years later, age of 8 to 10. What do you think? 50? They retested them again 5 years later, ages 13 to 15. You can see a trend here, can't you? Now, this tells an interesting story, because you could have imagined it going the other way, couldn't you? You start off not being very good, but you get better as you get older. But this shows two things. One is we all have this capacity, and two, it mostly deteriorates. Now, a lot of things have happened to these kids as they've grown up, a lot. But one of the most important things that happened to them, I'm convinced, is that by now they've become educated. You know, they've spent 10 years at school being told there's one answer, it's at the back. And don't look. And don't copy, because that's cheating. I mean, outside schools, that's called collaboration, you know, but inside schools. Now, this isn't because teachers want it this way, it's just because it happens that way. It's because it's in the gene pool of education. We have to think differently about human capacity. We have to get over this old conception of academic, non-academic, abstract, theoretical, vocational, and see it for what it is, a myth. Secondly, we have to recognize that most great learning happens in groups, that collaboration is the stuff of growth. If we atomize people and separate them and judge them separately, we form a kind of disjunction between them and their natural learning environment. And thirdly, it's crucially about the culture of our institutions, the habits of the institution and the habitats that they occupy.
Now, when I saw that, I really don't have any opinions about what education should look like. I didn't look at that and go, oh, well, that really means a lot. For me, what really hit me on that was actually one of the first lines he said. He says, the current system was designed and conceived for a different age. And I thought about that for myself. I thought about all the systems of my life, and I thought my default systems of my life were designed and conceived for a different age. When I was 22, or when I was 32, or when I was 42. And now in the ripe, over-the-edge, middle age marker of 46, I'm just challenged to say, all right, what are the things that I am just mindlessly doing because I've always done them? What are the values I've had that I've always had that really work for a different time period but don't work for me? I don't mean moral values. I just mean the values of how you spend your time, the values of how you manage money, the values of how you plan for the future, the values, all these things. I just realized where I am right now, I have to stage for the next run. I just can't keep doing the same things that I've always done and expect the same results. I'm in a different spot than I have ever been this year than any other year, and I'm changing things that are part of my normal default systems because I have a new run that's coming up, and I can't just have the current system. That was a Kairos moment for me. Things changed. Another Kairos moment for me happened later in January in 2010. At the end of 2010, we had a game change campaign. All of us who were part of Crossroads and committed, we made game change commitments above and beyond what we regularly give. And, you know, in 2010, if you were here, we had commitments of $48 million. And I went into 2011 being like everybody else going, woohoo, yeah, $48 million. It's all going to get it done. We're going to get her done. We're going to get them all done. India, South Africa, CityLink, different sites of Crossroads all over the region. Yeah, awesome. It's going to be great. You know, I just thought, man, it's going to be great, 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 great year. Got it in 2011. And we started crunching the numbers. We started doing cash flow analysis. We started taking a closer look at exactly what was needed in all these projects because as time elapsed, we got more data in. And as we were looking at these, I started feeling more and more stressed. I started feeling, oh my goodness, wow, this is not a slam dunk. This was stressful. Because you had to look at new staffing things, new different things of things that you couldn't even control before. And I was amazingly stressed out. And in one of our board meetings in January, I told our board that. And I remember, never forget what Jim Bechtold said. Jim Bechtold, who probably the first person that ever had the idea of Crossroads. Probably if you had to say who's the very, it was probably Jim. He was driving into work with Brian Wells. And he said, hey, well, maybe we ought to start a church. And then they invited me to come to Cincinnati And that's where the whole thing started. I was lamenting with Jim that I felt as stressed and as uncertain now as I did when it was 1996 and we had 35 people going to start a new church. I felt more stressed, more uncertain than ever before. And Jim said, I don't forget what he said. He said, well, being on the edge of kingdom work always feels the same. And that was a Kairos moment, like ding, Kairos moment. I said, oh my goodness, wow, you're right. I've bought into this lie that somehow, the older I got and the bigger the thing that I was a part of got, the more stable my life should be, the more I should be able to kick into maintenance mode, and I kick into maintenance mode, and then all life is good. And all of a sudden, I realized, no, if I'm going after what God wants in my life, it will always feel a bit scary, always. The numbers may change, the situation may change, but it'll always. And then I started thinking, reflecting on it, and I started retaining the awareness that there isn't a single person that I model and desire to be like in this book, not a single person that ever maintained. Let me say it again. There's not a single person ever in this book that ever was exalted or had a great life because they maintained. I'm all for systems getting so they allow us to have an easier life. I'm all for that. I'm just saying that I had bought into this lie that said, man, things should start getting easier. I should just maintain more of the same. No, it was a Kairos moment. No, I want God to be using me in every way possible. I want new adventures, and God using me in new ways and new adventures will always bring with it uncertainty and stress. That's called faith. It's a Kairos moment for me. Another one happened when I was over the summer. I got to go over to Greece with some friends and was able to tour Corinth. Corinth is one of the cities where the Apostle Paul started a new church. And there's two parts in the Bible, two books in the Bible, 1 Corinthians and 2 Corinthians, that are his letters, two letters he wrote to them under supernatural inspiration of the Holy Spirit. That's why they're still preserved for us today. And here's a pic from the city of Corinth. This in the beginning, in the center, is a road, and this road heads right, if it goes to the right off of the screen, this heads right down to the wharf. So you would come up with your ships, everybody would come into Corinth and bring all their trades, all their goods, or the Apostle Paul is coming to introduce people to Jesus, would walk up this road into the business section. And it really struck me because I thought, wow, fascinating. The very first place he would have gone and interacted with was people who were in business. One of the things that God has asked me to do in increasing ways over the last 5-10 years is be increasingly passionate about bringing relief and real life change to people who are in poverty or in difficult circumstances. And some of my best creativity and energy has gone towards CityLink, has gone towards our work in India and South Africa, has gone towards things in WizKids, some of my best cheerleading of that stuff. And it's all been the way God wanted me to be focused on. I don't regret any of that. And I know he wants me to continue to keep my eye on that ball and us as a church to keep our eye on the ball, but it was a Kairos moment because I realized, never forget, the gospel first went to people in business. It was normal people who were in business that were where the Apostle Paul went. It was the backbone of the church and still is the backbone of the church today. And it really cemented in my mind when I went through a museum there in Corinth and they had a copper plate. And this copper plate was a mirror. In the book of 1 Corinthians chapter 13, Paul says, now we see in a mirror dimly, but in the fullness of time we will see him, you know, in a complete way. And the mirror was an example of this. Now, these mirrors, no matter how nice they were and how polished they weren't like today's mirrors. You couldn't see an exact representation of yourself. And that's kind of what it's like spiritually for us. No matter how much we think we know God, we still don't fully get it. We just don't. There's ripples in our understanding. We don't fully get it. Another thing that struck me was there was no public mirrors. You wouldn't spend the money for big sheets of copper in the middle of public restrooms. They had no such thing. If you understood to understand the point he was making, what meant that you had to have money, because only people who had money actually had this mirror. And so it just was a kairos moment. I said, man, let's not forget about normal, everyday people who are doing okay financially, who have jobs. That is a focus. We'll maintain a focus. It was a kairos moment for me. Another kairos moment happened when I was going to Alaska. I have always wanted to go to Alaska. It's been on my bucket list for years. Finally got to do it this last summer. And a very grueling, difficult trip. Part of the difficult thing that happened was my motorcycle I prepared had broken down. And a group of people had to go ahead of us. There was five guys that went on ahead while three of us stayed back. And I could never get caught back up to them. So finally, I got on the phone and called them. I was just south of the Canadian border and said, hey, I don't know when I'm going to get to you. Even when I do get to you, I'm really tired. You guys have taken a lot of vacation time off. If you want to go up to Prudhoe Bay or make sure you make it, just go ahead. I'll get there when I get there. Three of the guys took off and went, and two of the guys got back on the phone and said, hey, Brian, we came here not to go to Alaska. We came here to be with you. So you get here whenever you get here, and it's all good. This is a picture of the five of us, five of my greatest friends, right at the board when we finally got there. And my son, it was a kairos moment for me of the sweetness of friendship. It was a kairos moment for me when I realized I normally don't spend a lot of strategic time thinking about who my friends are going to be, how I'm going to spend time with them, the money I'm going to spend. My friends are important to me. It's as important a thing as anything else in my life. And Jesus himself says, I no longer call you servants, I call you friends. Friendships are going to be more important to me in 2012 than ever before because of that kairos moment. It was apparent when I was on the phone. It was as if God was working and saying to me, Brian, excuse me, can't talk to your mouthful. This is important. Get this. Last one I'll share with you. There's a friend of mine who I just developed a friendship with. He was a trainer at the gym where I kind of work out. He was in a strong group with me at the last group. He ended up giving his life to Christ. It was an amazing thing. His name is Steve. And then I just talked to him a couple weeks later. I said, you know, I've been kind of going over and working out, and I'm glad I am. I know something's better than nothing, but I just feel like I'm in a rut. I'm just going to do the same elliptical thing, kind of peter around, doing chin-ups, push-ups. You know, I just feel like I'm just going through the motions. He said, well, I'll design a workout for you. I said, really? Okay. So he spent a workout or two with me, kind of wrote down these different workouts to do. I swore more than I normally do because they were so hard. I swore at him. It was like, I'm dying. It was awful. And I was more sore than ever before. And after about two or three weeks of this, I did these, and a couple things happened. Number one, I started to feel a bit of the benefits. But the other thing I realized was, you know, this is the first time an individual has been an authority over me, and I submitted to somebody. I made the decision to submit to whatever Steve said and do whatever Steve said. I don't have a single solo authority in my life right now. I'm the President of the United States, perhaps. I don't have a single solo authority. I'm out of my parents' roof. I don't have a singular manager that manages me. I have a board that I'm in submission to. But it's rare for me to actually have a person who I am in total submission to, and I chose to be in submission to his workout regimen. And it was a good discipline for me. It really was. In fact, many of us, we don't like to submit. We think submission is bad, and this is why you're stuck with God, because you don't submit to God either. If we can't submit to other people, we don't have the muscular, spiritual capacity to submit to God. And so in that simple thing of submitting to Steve's workout regimen, it made me all that much more committed in the year 2012 to be more submitted to God. And kairos moments are going to come up that I don't even know about yet. But I made the decision ahead of time. God, I will submit to you. This will be your year and not mine. God, I thank you for the things that you've been working and the things that you've been doing. And I know you've been doing things in every life in here that we've forgotten about or haven't even noticed. We thought it was just coincidental, but no, it was your hand. It was providential. It was significant. It was special. So I pray that you would continue to reveal, allow us to retain, and redirect the lives that you've blessed us with. I pray that this would be a year that would honor you more than any other year in our life. We want to be in submission to you, at least I do. Thank you for being gracious and patient. Amen. We're going to do a song right now that we did earlier. It's actually from the Bible. It's from the book of Psalms, chapter 31. And it's an example of how Jesus went through this process. Jesus was a Jew, and he was very well versed in the Jewish scriptures and in the Psalms. And he had memorized Psalm chapter 31. I believe he had it memorized because he starts quoting it in an hour of need while he's on the cross. When he's on the cross, there's seven distinct sayings that he gives while he's dying. One of them is, "Into your hands I commit my spirit." And this passage, this is a song that's set to this, and it's because Jesus, he had retained these words. He'd retained these words, and he redirected his life to these words. He didn't run away from the cross. He directed his life to the cross because he retained the truth in these words. Let's stand and maybe make these our words as well.